loose because you didn't want to get caught associating with a slavery kingpin. And then you projected. You assumed DIA must be worried about the same kind of thing. But what if DIA's worry is 1,000 times worse than CIA's was? What if DIA isn't worried about getting caught just associating with a slavery kingpin, but about being in business with one? Carl looked down and shook his head. Damn. Tell me, Kay, she said, if I'm right, if it were to get out, how much of a scandal? There was a pause. Hanazaki said, it would be unprecedented. I can't even imagine. Prison time for the principals would be the least of it. The whole organization would be dismantled. Ain't it pretty to think so, Carl said. But yeah, there'd be a shitstorm for sure. Regardless, she said, for DIA, Sorm is a two-edged sword. If he ever turns on them, it's really bad. So they have to keep him happy. Right, Carl said. Which is why when Sorm gets wind of Van's investigation and the sealed indictment and tells Gant to kill a high UN official for him, Gant clicks his heels. Livia nodded. Because DIA cannot possibly take the risk of Sorm being indicted and offering up his relationship with DIA as part of a plea. But then why not just kill Sorm? Kanazaki asked. Now we're getting somewhere, Livia said. First, my understanding is that Sorm is a ghost, very hard to get to. Is that right? Yes, Kanazaki said. At least it was true when we were running him. Carl laughed. I think that's a charitable view of who was running whom. When you owe the bank $1 million, it's your problem. When you owe $1 billion, the problem is the bank's. Anyway, Livia said. The point is, Sorm is paranoid, a survivor, not at all an easy man to get to, even for Dylan and DIA. So even if you decided at some point he'd become more a liability than an asset, you'd have a hard time doing anything about it. And Sorm's no fool. How could he have survived as long as he has, other than by putting himself in the shoes of anyone who looks at him as an investment? Meaning? Kanazaki said. Meaning if you're Sorm, and you're paranoid under the best of circumstances that DIA might suddenly look at you and decide to cut their losses. How are you feeling when you learn some federal prosecutor in New York has prepared a sealed grand jury indictment? What do you think DIA is going to make of that? Of the possibility that if you're arrested and extradited and facing the rest of your life in prison, you might try to plead down your sentence with an explosive story about how you and DIA are business partners in modern slavery. You'd be even more paranoid, Kanazaki said. Even more careful. Livia nodded. Correct. We've been assuming Sorm went on the run because of Van's indictment. Maybe that, too. But more likely, the one he's really running from, Kanazaki said, is DIA. Damn, Carl said. So Sorm didn't want Van dead just to eliminate the threat from Van. He also knew it was the only way to eliminate the threat from DIA. God damn it. I told him, the damn Dalai Lama, I told him he had to watch his back. Ah, shit. I'm sorry, Livia said, but it feels right, and I think there's one more thing. I'm not sure, but... She paused to think it through, then went on. Put yourself in Dylan's shoes, and we need to, because that's what he's been doing with us. You've had a great run with Sorm, made God knows how much money, created a giant slush fund, bought secret influence with a dozen governments, sidelined your CIA rivals on every important project. You're like an investor who made a killing in a bull market. But that market's gotten more and more volatile lately. Huge new risks. You feel like you've been riding the market down, and what you're looking for now is a way to get out. Are you going to miss that opportunity? Silence. I mean, you guys tell me. You know Dylan. If Sorm demanded that Dylan kill Van, Kanazaki said, he'd be relieved when it was done, reassured. Because why would Dylan take the risk of killing a high UN official when he could have solved his volatility in the markets problem by just killing Sorm himself? Carl said, you're saying killing Van was a way for Dylan to prove his bona fides. Maybe, Kanazaki said. In fact, probably Dylan would have preferred not to kill Van at all. With Sorm dead, Van wouldn't be a threat, so why take the risk? Yeah, Carl said, shaking his head. But he decided to kill Van anyway, to get close to Sorm. God damn. If so, Kanazaki said, that means that if Dylan really does want out of this market, now would be a golden chance to do it. Carl nodded. Yeah, and he probably tells Sorm something like, problem solved, now let's review your operations because you know me, I'm all about efficiency and elegance and killing two birds, and I have some ideas about how we can lower our risks and double our profits. Oh, and make sure to turn off your new burner and all that, because all I want to do is protect you from here on out. Sorm smells all that money and thinks he can trust this guy now, so he agrees to meet him. Livia looked at him. Almost there. One more step. Carl gave her a wan smile. Preach it, sister. I could listen to you all day. All right. Cops think motive, means, and opportunity. Okay? You're Dylan. You want out of the market. There's your motive. Sorm suddenly trusts you. There's your opportunity. Now, what are your means? Especially if you're all about killing two birds with one stone. Carl looked at her. For a second, his expression was what she had seen earlier, what she imagined he would look like behind a rifle scope. His means, he said, are you and me. Yes, I think so. It would certainly be elegant. A.L., Kanazaki said, has anyone ever told you you'd make a great intelligence officer? No thanks.
He meant it as a compliment, Carl said.
Kanazaki laughed. Forget I said it. The main thing is, it makes sense. Dylan wants out of a market that's come to pose unacceptable risks. He wants to close all accounts, not just Sorm, but also the two of you. What better way, what more elegant way, to do that than to let you figure out that Dylan and Sorm will both be at the night market and get you to make a run at them there? Dylan will hang back somehow, Carl said. He'll give us Sorm and drop us then. That's the plan, anyway, if he's going for elegance. You know how I know you're right? Kanazaki said. Long and fruitful experience with my considered judgment? Kanazaki laughed again. That, too. But also, isn't that exactly what Gant tried to do in Phnom Penh? Get you to kill the target, and then have you killed right after? I knew I'd seen this show before, Carl said. Now, let's just make sure they don't change the ending in the remake. Chapter 30. It was just past sunset, with pink fading to red in the western sky, when Dox and LaBie arrived at the night market. Dox had badly wanted to at least ride past the Sanam Golf Alley parking lot in that junkyard next to the gas station, but he knew he had to avoid routine recon like what he had done outside the Dalai Lama's office, because Dylan knew he knew, but didn't know he knew Dylan knew. So they did something different. LaBie took them wide of the market, approaching it from the northwest, then headed east along a narrow, rutted road hemmed in by encroaching vegetation. The road grew rougher and increasingly overgrown, and finally dead-ended past the market at the northeast corner of the golf course. The golf course was set back from the remnants of the road and surrounded by a perimeter of tall, thick foliage. Beyond the foliage was a fence topped by netting about 30 feet high, which seemed not to be working as well as expected, because all around on the ground were moldering golf balls. They dismounted and removed their helmets. Dox raised a shirt tail and wiped the sweat from his face. It smelled like jungle back here, and though the din of the market was audible, the insects around them were much louder. He pushed the bike deep into the foliage, ran the chain through a wheel and the helmets, and walked back to LaBie. You'd to go? She nodded. He checked his watch. 8:30. Plenty of time. They pulled on baseball caps, better than nothing against any circling bird drones, and walked west until they'd reached the northeast corner of the market. Dox had been expecting either to have to jump the corrugated fence or to break through it, but they were in luck. Beyond the vegetation, he could see a gap in the metal alongside the fence of the golf course. They pushed through the underbrush, walked right through the gap, and found themselves in a paved lot with lines of bright incandescent lights strung overhead, and dozens of antique cars and trucks displayed beneath them. Scores of people milled around, booing and awing at the vehicles, snapping photos, wandering in and out of the long, open-air, brick and corrugated metal buildings to either side, all of which seemed to be set up as some kind of Americana automotive time machine. Old gas pumps, vintage signage, and, of course, rows of classic cars and trucks. The area was relatively quiet, but the din, including a drum band from the sound of it, farther south was unmistakable.
"This is the antiques section," LaBie said. "The least crowded."
Docs nodded. "Looks just like it did online. Nice to finally be here in the flesh, though."
They headed south, and the crowds quickly grew denser and noisier. There were food trucks with tables and chairs set up neatly before them, an old-school barber shop complete with a revolving striped pole, and every vintage item imaginable, from vinyl records to leather jackets to jukeboxes and gumball machines. They kept moving, and after a few minutes reached the edge of the main market. Before them were thousands of colorful tents and stalls, countless shoppers and diners and revelers, families with babies in strollers, roving teens, and pensioners probably on the hunt for bargains. The sounds of laughter and conversation were mixed with the throbbing beat of a taiko ensemble, and the air was suffused with a dozen delicious smells, grilled seafood of every kind, roasting meat, fried noodles, coconut pancakes and custard and crepes. It was Doc's kind of place, and on any other night he would have been enjoying it. But tonight, even beyond the ordinary operational edge, he couldn't shake the feeling that they were missing something. A miniature drone overhead, or Dylan somehow having managed to think one move ahead of them.
LaVie looked at him.
"What is it?"
"Not sure, but something's bugging me. Let's duck into this store here."
It was one of the brick structures at the perimeter. They went inside and wandered toward the back, surrounded by cluttered collections of retro Japanese anime toys, stuffed animals, Hello Kitty dolls, and little Bo Peep dresses that walked the delicate line between adorable and fetishistic.
"Sometimes I can get paranoid about sniper hides," he told her. "Occupational hazard. Once you've been on the right end of a few thousand-yard kills, you start imagining being on the wrong end."
"You think Dylan's got a sniper rifle?"
"No, that ain't it. This isn't sniper terrain, and I don't think it will be favorable for one of his micro-drones either. The lighting sucks, the crowds are too dense, and the overall area is too big. But, I don't know. We're not making it any harder for him by sticking together, for one thing."
"You think we should split up?"
"Well, I hate to, especially because the phones are off. At least for," he checked his watch, "another 15 minutes.
He paused and thought. The phones. The way Kanazaki was going to zero in on Sorms and Dylan's, and he realized what had been nagging at him.
"Hey," he said, "you think old Dylan might have access to the kind of real-time cell phone monitoring we're about to get from Kanazaki? I mean, he would, wouldn't he?"
She nodded. "Seems like a safe bet."
"Well, when we turn on our phones, then even if he hasn't managed to track them yet, won't some DIA Geek Squad guy immediately focus on the phones that just came on in the middle of the night market?"
She nodded. "You're right."
"I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but if there's one thing I'm sure of about Dylan, it's that he's one smooth son of a bitch."
"But if we can't use the phones, how will Fallon tell us when Sorm tries to call Leak Pie?"
Docs looked at his watch again. "Well, we'd need to get new ones, but I haven't seen any for sale here. And even if there were, it wouldn't solve our problem, a brand new phone getting switched on in the middle of the market. Besides, we don't have time to activate a new phone."
A half dozen young girls wandered in, high school or maybe college age. Docs watched them for a moment and was struck by inspiration.
"Hang on," he said. "I believe I have identified a solution to our conundrum. It's not perfect, but it won't be what the bad guys are looking for, I'm sure of that."
He walked over to the girls.
"Pardon me," he said. "I apologize for the intrusion. Do any of you speak English?"
One of the girls nodded and said in a heavy Thai accent, "I speak English."
"Wonderful. Young lady, I would like to buy 2 of your mobile phones."
"I'm sorry?" He wondered whether she spoke as well as she had claimed, or maybe it was just the nature of what he'd said that had thrown her.
"I understand my request is unusual, but I badly need 2 phones tonight, and I'm happy to pay for the opportunity."
He pulled out a roll of bills. How about $500 per phone? He counted out 10 Benjamins. Or, hell, make it 600. I don't have time to haggle. He counted out two more. The girl looked at her friends, then back to him.
You're serious?
Very serious, yes. And here's another 200 to prove it. 700 per phone. He pulled out another two bills. The girl consulted with her friends again. They spoke among themselves increasingly excitedly. Then several of them frantically dug into their purses. One pulled out a phone, followed a moment later by her friend. I'm sorry, ladies. I believe we have two winners. He took the phones and handed the girls 700 apiece. He looked at the units, both older model iPhones, a good bargain for everyone. Say, these aren't passcode protected, are they? Before the translator could interpret, the girls had taken back the phones, unlocked them, and turned off the passcode protection. He looked and saw they were deleting all their texts, which he could understand they might not want a stranger to read. Not that he'd have any interest or could decipher the tie anyway. They handed the phones back and he switched the language on each unit to English. He offered them each a Y, the phones sandwiched between his palms. Thank you, ladies, and I hope you won't think I'm exaggerating when I say you might have just saved my life. The two girls both exclaimed, thank you, in English. Then they all ran off, probably to buy all sorts of night market goodies they hadn't thought they could afford. That was nicely done, LaBie said. I once bought a truck the same way. He handed her one of the units. They checked the phone numbers, called each other to confirm, and headed back to the entrance. Docs looked out at the sky again. He still didn't like it. You know what? Let's stay put for the moment. I have an idea. He downloaded Signal to the girl's phone, then used it to call Kanazaki. After the exchange of IDs, he said, how we doing over there? Nothing yet. Well, here's the deal. I have a new phone I'll be using. Obviously, Signal's working fine now, but let me give you the number in case I'm out of Wi-Fi range and you need to call me directly. He read Kanazaki the number. Kanazaki said, what's this about? Just being careful, that's all. You won't be able to use the old number anymore. Reach me at this one. He clicked off again. Come on, he said. They headed out, and within a minute had found a pushcart vendor selling fried insects. He took out the burner he'd been using and powered it up. LaBie obviously knew what he had in mind. Without saying a word, she did the same, handed him the phone, and started ordering various fried insects from the old woman pushing the cart. While the two of them were engaged, Docs kneeled as though to adjust his hiking sandals and slipped the old phones into a box on a shelf at the bottom of the cart. When he stood, LaBie was holding two bags of fried insects. The old woman gave them each a Y and moved off. Docs watched her go. You don't think Dylan would hurt her, do you? LaBie shook her head. Even if someone tracks the phones, they'll see her and instantly realize what we did. I hope you're right. I've got enough things I'm going to burn in hell for. He upended the bag and poured a bunch of whatever was inside it into his mouth. Dang, them's good eating. LaBie handed her his. You don't like insects? He said. There was a pause.
When I was a girl, sometimes that's all I could find to eat.
He suddenly felt like shit.
I'm sorry, LaBie, I didn't. It's fine, just not a good association.
She gave him a small smile. Not as bad as the port, though, so you don't have to worry about my throwing up. He liked that she was joking with him. He wasn't sure if it was a sign of increasing comfort or dealing with the stress of an op. Probably both. He checked his watch. 9 o'clock. Time to let Fallon know we've got new phones. He took out Fallon's card, input the number, and waited while the call went through. Hello, came the familiar gravelly voice. It's me. Got a new phone. Good timing, too. Guess who just called? He looked at LaBie and nodded. Storm? You bet. I didn't pick up. I texted back that I couldn't talk and asked him, what time? It was oblique for communication security purposes, and also exactly what he would have expected Leak Pie to ask, given that they'd already agreed on the place. He texted back right away. 10 o'clock sharp. Docs felt a nice little hit of adrenaline snake out through his gut. Outstanding. Sir, when this is done, I am buying you that Singha beer, though I myself, you'll be unsurprised to learn, will again be drinking Chang. Well, you won't be the first friend of mine who's also a Philistine. I'm going to stay in the area in case you need me, just south of where the meeting is supposed to go down.
Appreciate that. Hopefully everything will go smoothly, but it's good to know there's backup if we need it.
He clicked off. You heard, right? Levy nodded. 10 o'clock. Now all we need is... Dox's phone buzzed. Signal. He answered.
I got him, Kanazaki said.
Dox nodded to Levy.
Tell me.
First, that number you told me might be Sorm's. It came on 5 minutes ago. The parking lot west of the market. It made a call and received a text back.
I know about that one. Anything else?
Yes. As predicted, 2 brand new burners, both activated at virtually the same time. The first from the same position as the call from the parking lot.
Sorm.
Yes. The second from right in the middle of the market.
Dylan.
Yes. Damn, that wasn't much more than 50 yards from where they were standing. They were lucky they hadn't just run into the guy. Or unlucky.
Are they moving?
I don't know. The phones are already off. But I was able to get a machine text translation of the call. Dox grinned.
I meant it that time I called you a miracle worker.
Dylan wanted to know where Sorm was. Sorm was being cagey. He told Dylan to go to a place called Soul Garage in the northwest corner of the market. You know what that is?
Dox had practically memorized everything he'd seen and learned online. I know exactly what it is. A custom and vintage motor scooter place in one of the market's quieter sections.
Dylan was clearly trying to draw Sorm out, asking Sorm if he was already there. Sorm said, not yet. Just wait for me in front. I don't think Dylan was happy. He was expecting Sorm to be in position. Then you could drop Sorm, and he could drop you. Now, he's the one who's going to be a sitting duck.
I doubt Dylan would let that happen. But yes, most likely he'll be heading in that direction. Call me if anything changes. I'm going after him.
He clicked off, his blood up now at the prospect of how close Dylan was and how close he was to killing the man.
Dylan's likely heading towards Soul Garage from south of us. Sorm, I don't know. He might be heading there from the parking lot on the west side of the market, but he wants Dylan to be there first, so it's possible he's going to check on the truck beforehand.
We should go for Dylan first.
Listen, you go to the truck. Sorm might be heading there now. That'll give you a shot at Sorm while I go after Dylan. From the timing of their conversation, I expect I'm already behind him, but if I hurry, I can pick him up.
I don't want to...
No, Labi, you can ride in front any time you like, but tonight I'm taking on Dylan. He killed the Dalai Lama. You can have Sorm. That's the deal. Take it or leave it.
He hadn't meant to be so harsh, but this was not the time to fuck around. She looked at him. I thought we were partners.
Damn it, she looked so hurt it might have killed him, but he couldn't afford the distraction. We are partners, with 2 separate jobs to do. Go to the damn truck. If Sorm shows up, he's yours. If he doesn't, make your way to Soul Garage, and that'll be your second chance. Now go on, get. There's no time.
He turned before her expression could change his mind and headed northwest across the market, his head swiveling as he moved. With all the people and tents and activity, it was about as bad a counter-surveillance environment as imaginable, so Dylan would be having a hard time watching his back. The problem was, the same factors that would make it hard for Dylan to spot him were making it hard for him to find Dylan. He cleared the tents and walked quickly up an avenue with long, low-slung brick buildings to either side, each with a half dozen stores selling anything anyone had ever invented that was vintage and kitsch. Unlike the antiques section on the opposite side of the market, it was shadowy over here, the only illumination coming from a few incandescent bulbs strung overhead and from inside the stores. And though both sides of the thoroughfare were lined with antique trucks and microbuses, the finer specimens and the crowds they attracted were all on the other side. The street grew darker. There were no people here at all. He didn't like it. He hugged the line of vehicles to his right, his eyes scanning the long, low rooftops, his hand around the grip of the supergrade under his shirt.
Where are you, you son of a bitch? Where?
A soft voice came from 8 feet behind him. Don't move, Dox. Dox froze. A huge hit of adrenaline mushroomed through his torso. Bastard had ghosted right up on him from between the parked trucks. He didn't move his head, but swept the area in front of him with his eyes. He saw nothing threatening, or, unfortunately, useful.
How you doing, Dylan?
He was surprised and not displeased that his voice sounded so calm. I'm fine. I want you to very slowly take your hand out from under your shirt, your empty hand. Docs complied. Good. Now, where's the woman?
Ah, cherchez la femme. A cliché, maybe, but still, words to live by, if you ask me.
A second went by. Then there was a shock and an explosion of white behind his eyes. He staggered. For a second, he thought he'd been shot. But then he realized Dylan had pistol-whipped him in the head.
That's funny, Dylan said, from a distance again, but not as far as the first time. Maybe 6 feet now, or five.
You want to hear something serious? There's lots more where that came from. Those three men in Pattaya were my best.
Docs felt blood trickling down his neck from what must have been a gash in his scalp. It didn't bother him. On the contrary, it was nice to have proof he was still alive. And besides, he'd been hit in the head more times than he could count, with fists, chairs, and on one memorable occasion with a rubber mallet, usually without much effect. He was hard-headed, figuratively, of course, but literally, too. But Dylan didn't know that. He'd think the blow from the gun butt had caused more damage than it had. Plus, the man had obviously taken Pattaya very personally. If Docs could engage him further, and hell, Docs had engaged experts in his time, he knew no one who could do it better. He might be able to get Dylan to momentarily forget the rule that if you could touch it, you could take it, and get closer than he ought to for the satisfaction of inflicting more punishment. A long shot, no doubt, but actually a pretty sunny alternative compared to the overall current range of options.
I feel your pain, Doc said, putting a little grogginess into his tone and making sure to wobble as though the pistol whipping had messed up his balance and coordination. That sad moment when you realize your best just weren't good enough.
I fought with those men, asshole, Dylan said. Closer now, 4 feet at most. Bled with them.
Well, I don't mean to sound Pollyannish here, but the good news, I guess, is they're not bleeding anymore.
Okay, Dylan said, at most 3 feet away now. I'm going to ask you one more time. If you give me anything other than a straight answer, I'll put a bullet in your head. Now, where is the woman?
Damn, not as close as Docs had been hoping, but maybe close enough. And anyway, he sensed this was the end of the line. He relaxed. Tension would slow him down and telegraph the move. He would just say whatever incongruous thing popped into his mind, hope it provided a second's distraction, and spin and go for the disarm. Probably it wouldn't work, but there was nothing complicated to consider. There just weren't any other options.
"Here's the thing about women," he started to say.
Labie's voice cut him off.
"If you even think about pulling that trigger, it'll be the second to last thing that goes through your brain."
Without an instant's worth of thought, Docs spun clockwise, bringing his right arm up and out, and snatched the gun straight out of Dylan's hand. Labie took a long step away, keeping her gun pointed at Dylan's back.
"Damn," Doc said, "those disarms really work, or can work anyway. I'd always hoped never to have to try one."
He glanced at the gun in wonder and saw a sweet little SIG P229. Then he was flooded with a surge of relief so strong it actually made his knees buckle.
"Hoo boy," he said, "I'll tell you the truth. If you'd asked me a few seconds ago, I wouldn't have predicted I'd be standing here right now. Oh, Labie, don't you ever again let me try to tell you what to do. In fact, I want you to start telling me."
Dylan looked at him. "I'm not here for the two of you, you dumb hick. I'm here for Sorm."
Docs laughed grimly.
"Well, I expect that's half true, the wrong half."
Labie stayed silent and steady. She knew Dylan was his, as Sorm was hers.
"What happened to you?" Doc said, keeping the SIG on Dylan. "Back in the day, you were a damn hero."
Dylan sighed, apparently realizing his last ruse was done.
"The higher you go, the more different it looks."
"Yeah?"
Labie said, apparently unable to contain herself.
"How does selling children into sex slavery look from your exalted position? Because I could tell you a lot about how it looks from mine."
Dylan looked at Docs. "I don't suppose there's any way we might start over?" He sounded more amused by the absurdity of the notion than hopeful about its possibility. Docs had to admire the man's cool.
"If there was," he said, "you blew it when you killed the Dalai Lama."
"The Dalai Lama?
Docs stepped to the right so LeBee would be offline in case the bullet went all the way through, and shot Dylan in the forehead. Dylan's head jerked and a spasm went through his arms. His legs folded, and he collapsed backward, hitting the pavement with a dull thud.
"Yeah," Doc said. "The Dalai Lama. That was for him, you son of a bitch, and I think he'd even have approved."
"Take his phone," LeBee said. "Sorm." Docs kneeled and started going through Dylan's pockets. Dylan had been wearing cargo shorts like any good tourist, and it was a wonder Docs hadn't heard the man clanking when he'd snuck up from behind, because he was carrying two cell phones, one satellite phone, and one cell phone tracker, not to mention the SIG, two spare magazines, and a nice little Emerson CQC-10 folder that Docs immediately took as a trophy, a habit he had once tried to explain to Rain, but that the man would never understand.
"You shouldn't have followed me," he said as he stripped Dylan of the gear. "Not that I'm ungrateful, Lord knows, but your best shot at Sorm might have been at the truck. We better hope he's coming this way."
It was a good thing the belly band had extra compartments and was expandable, because at this point he had enough gear to fill a damn backpack. He got out of his shirt, pulled off the belly band, and started filling it. He glanced at LeBee, who was scanning the area, her gun at low ready.
"Hey, did you hear me?"
She paused her scanning and looked at him.
"We stick together."
It was such a simple statement, and more a conclusion than an argument, but he found he had no response, so he just nodded and said, "All right, then." Among Dylan's phones, only one of the mobiles was turned on, so that must have been the unit he was using to talk to Sorm. Docs kept that one out. By the time he was done filling the belly band, he could tell it would be too much to run with, so he fixed it around his back and across a shoulder, then pulled the shirt on again, leaving it unbuttoned. A bit of a wild look, but the main thing was access to the supergrade. Wherever Sorm might be coming from, it seemed a safe bet he was still planning on meeting Dylan at Soul Garage, so they hurried in that direction. The avenue grew lighter again, but visitors were still sparse. At the far end was an open garage with black and white tiled flooring in front, and a sign overhead reading, Soul Garage. A half dozen vintage scooters were lined up in the street before it. In between, on the sidewalk, were a few tables and chairs occupied by a handful of people, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. It looked like Soul Garage was as much a club as it was a shop. They slowed and ducked between a pair of antique fire trucks parked 50 feet down the avenue. LeBee started scanning behind them. Docs put his back to hers and scanned the other way. "See anything?" he asked.
"No."
Dylan's phone buzzed. Docs glanced at LeBee. She nodded. He clicked the answer button and raised the phone to his head. "Yeah," he said, trying to imitate Dylan's smooth voice and Yankee accent, and keeping his voice low as though trying not to be heard.
"Where are you?"
The accent was weird. Southeast Asian, French, he couldn't tell.
"At Soul Garage. Where are you?" "I'm looking at Soul Garage. Who is this?"
Dead phone.
"Damn it," Doc said. "He made us, but he's close."
They looked around wildly. They saw nothing.
"He must have been across from it," LeBee said. "If he's heading south toward the container, he's on the other side of those buildings. Come on!"
She pulled the Glock and took off running. Docs followed close behind, gripping the supergrade. At the first break in the long buildings, she cut left, then right again. 30 yards ahead were the tents and lights and crowds.
"Slow down," Doc said. "Slow down. This is how Dylan got me. I was moving too fast and didn't spot where he'd set up."
But she didn't listen. Damn, she was fast. He was having trouble keeping up. At the edge of the tents and heading south was a short man in beige slacks and a white button-down shirt, the kind of outfit designed not to be noticed. The man had gray hair, was holding a cell phone to his head, and was moving about as quickly as possible without his speed becoming obvious.
"Slow down, damn it,"
Doc said, managing to catch up and grabbing LeBee's arm.
"I think that's him."
The man must have been psychic, or just very lucky, because at that instant he glanced back. His eyes widened in recognition when he saw them and his mouth dropped open in fear. Then he turned and took off into the market. Docs and LeBee sprinted after him, LeBee slightly ahead. Immediately Sorm was swallowed up by the crowds, but the course of his passage was clear. There were shouts and people being shoved aside and knocked down. Someone screamed, and a food cart with several fryers on it went over, coating the sidewalk with boiling oil.
Labi leaped over it, but there were more obstructions ahead. Sorm was obviously throwing everything he could grab as he ran, and it was working. Dozens of people were on the ground or milling angrily in his wake, and it was slowing them down a lot. An angry Taiman yelled something at Dox and tried to grab him as he passed. Someone else shoved him. He kept running, Labi pulling ahead, faster and more nimble than he was. A thought blossomed in his mind, crystal clear amid all the confusion. Why would this human trafficking kingpin be alone? They'd been dumb not to consider it before, and now Labi was totally intent on Sorm, tunnel vision. Dox slowed and scanned, and saw a Taiman emerge from behind a stall, a gun coming up. Labi! Down! She crouched instantly. Dox put three rounds in the man's chest. The man staggered back. Labi hit him twice more. The man fell. People screamed and scattered. Sorm kept running. Labi leaped after him. Dox followed. Well, there go our well-intentioned attempts at subtlety, I guess, keeping the supergrade up in a two-handed grip at chin level, moving as quickly as he could while trying not to overlook another. A second man popped out from behind a stall as Labi went past. He took aim at her back. Dox put a round in the man's spine and kept galloping straight in, firing as he moved, hitting the man with multiple rounds. The man fell and Dox leaped right over him. He heard more shots and screams ahead and thought, oh no, please no. He ran harder, not caring anymore if he missed someone, but he needn't have worried. The shots must have been Labi's because another man was lying crumpled on the pavement, the screaming people around him scattering. Then they were through the crowds. He saw Sorm again, 40 yards ahead, with Labi 20 yards behind him. A semi with a container attached was pulling out of the lot south of the golf course and already moving fast. Sorm ran past the front end to the other side and then disappeared as it overtook his position. The truck accelerated more. Labi dashed out ahead of it. She took aim at the driver. The driver must have panicked because he hauled the wheel left. Labi fired. The truck went off the road. There was a drainage ditch alongside, and the left wheels went in. The truck shuddered, tilted. The driver hauled the wheel right and kept the truck from going over, but he overcorrected, swerving toward the gas station now. The right wheels went into the ditch on the other side, this one deeper than the first, and the driver tried to correct again, but the left wheels were up in the air now, and the truck was tilting, falling, heading straight toward the gas pumps. Dox saw Sorm again, running across the junkyard alongside the gas station. He must have gotten onto one of the running boards and then leaped clear as the truck started to go over. The truck fell to its side, sheared straight through the pumps, and shuddered to a stop. The station lights all blew. For an instant, everything was pitch dark. Then the ground beneath the container erupted in orange flame.
"Get the kids out!" Dox yelled. "I'm going after Sorm!"
Chapter 31. Livia had been so intent on Sorm that for a second she ignored Carl and started taking off after the fleeing man. Then she remembered herself and that little girl. She sprinted to the truck. Burning gasoline was spreading fast on the ground and along the exposed sides of the trailer. From inside, she could hear high, terrified screams. She raced around to the back. It was already scorchingly hot. The only light was from the dancing flames, and amid all the moving shadows she couldn't see clearly. She looked for the handle and saw it was secured with a chain and padlock. The screams from inside were louder now, even more terrified. She heard palms banging on the metal sides within. She whimpered in panic, fighting back a memory of having banged on the inside wall of the container as a child, trying to get someone, anyone, to hear and help her and Nassan. The flames had crept closer to the back of the truck. She looked around wildly. 10 yards behind her, on the other side of another drainage ditch, was the junkyard Carl had described in the van with Fallon and Leek Pie. She raced over and looked for something, anything. She saw a long steel rod, maybe a disused locking mechanism from a container. She grabbed it, thankful for its heft and solidity, and tore back to the truck. The flames were all over the trailer now. The children were keening inside. The driver pulled himself out one of the cab windows and leaped to the ground. He saw her, pulled a blade from under his shirt, and charged, screaming. No time to access the Glock. She screamed back and stabbed the end of the bar straight at his face. He managed to weave past, but she snapped the end in with a flick of both wrists and caught him in the neck. It staggered him.
She repeated the move, snapping the bar in harder, using more arm and hip action and catching him in the jaw this time. He fell to a knee. Before he could come up, she reversed her grip and swung the bar like a baseball bat, catching him above the ear and blasting him onto his side.
Keys, where are the keys?
She took a step toward the driver, then balked. Maybe the keys were in one of his pockets, maybe in a compartment inside the truck. Maybe they'd been thrown clear in the crash. Wherever they were, if her first guess wasn't right, it would be too late to try anything else. She dashed to the back of the truck again and jammed one end of the bar into the chain, spun it to take up slack, and put all her weight on the other end. There was a groan of metal straining against metal, but then the end of the bar hit the ground and she was out of leverage. She screamed in frustration, thinking, "Keys, you should have tried to find the keys!" But it didn't matter. Even if she'd chosen wrong, the bar was her only hope now. She went back to the door. The heat was becoming unbearable. She got the bar through the chain again, leaving more room this time, refusing to think about how hot the interior of the container must be now, or how much gas was right under the ground. The metal groaned, and she thought it would break, but it didn't. Her weight wasn't enough. She screamed again. The flames were everywhere now. It was hotter, so much hotter. She planted her feet in the door hinges and used the bar to walk herself up the side, like a slow-motion pole vaulter. The chain creaked and groaned, but didn't give. Finally, she was at the very top, upside down, her heels jammed in the side of the door, all the slack in the chain gone, all her weight on the bar, and every strand of muscle in her thighs straining to shove the bar one more inch, just one more inch. She was sobbing now. It wasn't going to work. Her skin was burning. She could smell her own singeing hair. The chain snapped and flew free. She plummeted. The end of the bar caught her in the midsection, and there was an explosion of nausea and pain. Then she slammed into the ground, the breath driven out of her. She realized with horror that her shirt was on fire. She rolled, remembering the drainage ditch somewhere close. She went over the edge and splashed into the water. The shock cleared her mind. She leaped out and raced back to the truck. She grabbed the lever, barely even feeling the metal searing her palms, and pushed it high. The locking bars cleared their fasteners. She wrenched open the door, and dozens of shrieking, crying children began stumbling out, practically trampling over each other in the extremity of their panic and streaming past her into the night. She tried to help them, dragging the fallen to their feet and pushing them along, searching face after terrified face by the light of the flames for that girl, that little girl, but not seeing her anywhere. In seconds, the children were gone, scattered. The container was empty. She staggered back from the heat, holding her throbbing side, crying. She heard Carl's voice from her right. "Labie!" She looked up and saw the big sniper coming toward her, dragging a struggling, staggering Swarm by the hair. She moved back farther. Carl reached her and threw Swarm at her feet. Swarm looked at the fire and shrank back from the heat. "You got the kids out?" Carl said. She nodded, looking at Swarm, feeling the dragon unfold, the hate inside her hotter than the fire. "I told you," Carl said. "He's yours, but those pumps could blow, and the cops will be here. Finish him and let's get." She pulled the Glock from her shorts pocket and pointed it at Storm's face. "Where is she?" she said. He shook his head, obviously petrified. His eyes darted from the fire to the gun and back again. "Where is she?" she screamed, flecks of spittle hitting him in the face. She put the muzzle of the Glock against his forehead. "Where is she? Where did you take her? Tell me! Tell me! Tell me where she is!" Storm trembled, his head shaking, mute with terror. Carl put a hand on her arm. "She's not here, LeBee, and he doesn't know. They're all the same to him. They're all the same." She screamed again, this time incoherently. No words, just a cry of grief and rage and despair. She grabbed Storm's hair and dragged him toward the truck. The heat was like a tangible thing, a throbbing, crawling force wrapping itself around her. "LaBee, no!" Carl shouted. "The pumps!" She didn't listen. She barely heard him. She got to the back doors, picked up the chain, and wrapped it around Storm's neck. His hands flew to his throat, but she had already slipped the other end through one of the locking bars and hauled it hard, jerking him back against the truck. She wrapped the excess in a kind of hangman's noose, then around and around and around his neck again. Storm's eyes bulged and he clawed uselessly at the lynx. His feet did a weird little tap dance on the ground. A fresh rush of burning gasoline surged from under the pumps and raced toward them over the ground. She didn't care. She didn't care if she burned, as long as Storm did. And then a strong arm encircled her stomach and dragged her back. She screamed in pain. The pole had done something to her and struggled, but the arm and the man behind it were implacable. Carl. He kept moving her back. "Where is she?" she screamed again. But Storm was past hearing. The flames were all over his legs now, moving up his sides. The burning puddle was a pond now, a river, a lake, and Storm was screaming at the center of it, his shirt on fire, his hair smoking, his skin melting, his mouth stretched wide in a rictus of perfect agony. "Where is she?" Olivia screamed again, but Carl kept moving, away from the truck, from the flames, from... One of the pumps erupted. The truck was engulfed in a fireball, Storm along with it. Carl threw her down and landed on top of her, covering her with his body. Pain erupted inside her. She shrieked. There was another explosion, a third. Burning debris rained down around them. They were 50 feet away, but the air was hot as an oven. Carl dragged her to her feet again. She staggered and he threw an arm around her waist and kept her going. She was distantly aware of him fumbling in a pocket. He took out a phone. "We're gonna need that pickup after all," he was saying, his voice almost supernaturally calm as he half-walked, half-carried her. "And boku quick." Fallon. But the thought felt far away, disconnected. "Right, the explosions and smoke and fire, afraid so. Just follow the big orange flames and you'll run right into us." A minute later, the white van screeched to a stop alongside them. Carl threw open the door, pulled her in, and slammed it shut behind them. Fallon was moving before the door was even closed. "We need a doctor," she heard Carl say. He laid her down across the plank seat. "She's burned, and I think hurt inside, too." He looked in her eyes. "LaBie, stay with me now. We're with old Fallon. I'll bet he can drive as well as you, or at least he'll try to. You're going to be all right." She barely heard him. She couldn't stop crying. "Where is she?" she said again. "Where?" Carl kneeled alongside her and touched her cheek. "I don't know, darling. I don't know. I couldn't save her," she said, and her body convulsed with a sob. "I couldn't. Oh, God, I couldn't save her." He stroked her singed hair. "You saved the others, darling. All of them. Everyone." His voice cracked, then he went on. "And you're going to save more. I told you. I know everything about you I need to, and I know that." The sobs took her then, pain and grief obliterating everything and carrying her away to the blackest, bleakest shores. She gripped his hand and pulled him in, and he put his arms around her, and she clutched him and sunk her face into his shoulder, and her body shook with the force of her tears, and he held her close and whispered her name, "LaBie, LaBie, LaBie," again and again and again. And then the world went dark, and she was gone. Chapter 32. 1 week later, Livia was back in Seattle. People were horrified at her sunburn. Stupid, she acknowledged. She'd gotten carried away. The tropical sun was no joke, and a stupid tuk-tuk accident had left her with cracked ribs and a bruised liver. Nothing life-threatening, just embarrassing, after all the shit she had survived as a cop. Little came in from wherever to debrief her. They sat in the cafeteria again, Livia with her mineral water, Little with his coffee. He told her a war had erupted between Thai and Ukrainian trafficking gangs. She told him that was fine with her, and she hoped they all killed each other. "You know what?" he said. "So do I." They sat for a moment, the silence weirdly comfortable. "Well," he said, "now that you've had a first-hand look and a chance to consider, what do you think of my offer?" She sipped her mineral water. "I'll tell you, B.D., after 10 days out there, I don't think there's that much for me to do."
"Yeah, it's almost like the job's already done."
She looked at him. Did he know, or was he fishing? He nodded.
"Oh, yes," he said,
and for a weird second, it was as though he had read her mind and was responding to her thoughts.
"I know.
She waited, unnerved. Vivavapit, he said. Sakta, Sorm, and Juntasa, and the senator before that. I know what you did, Livia. She tried to keep a poker face, but could feel herself paling in fear and surprise. He put a fist over his chest, and from this father's heart, thank you. She looked at him, still worried, but confused, too. I get it, he said. You thought I was working some kind of angle. Well, I was, and I am, just not what you think. He took his wallet from inside a pants pocket and pulled a photo from it. Little, maybe 10 years younger, with a beaming teenaged girl alongside him, her arms wrapped around his neck, the side of her face pressed against his. The little in the photo couldn't have looked more happy or proud. She wondered absently why not a photo on his phone, and realized he wanted something tangible. Presley, he said, because her mom was a fan. She's 15 in the photo. Now she's 24, or... He shrugged helplessly, stopped, and looked away. Just a walk to the grocery store on a summer evening, he said. Wanted to get some popcorn for a movie we were going to watch. Ratatouille. She liked animation. I still haven't watched it. I keep hoping... His voice caught. Maybe we'll see it together. You think we might? Livia looked at him, remembering that odd expression she'd noticed when they'd first talked about her women's self-defense class, suddenly understanding what it had meant. She felt a strange mixture of wariness and empathy. I don't know. He shook his head. No, of course not. No one knows. That's the worst part, not knowing. Can you imagine what it's like to have the kind of resources I do, and still to not know, to find nothing, not one single answer? It's like the phantom pain from an amputated soul. She wished she didn't, but she knew that pain acutely, right down to the metaphor. I'd end myself if I knew for sure she was gone, he went on. That's the truth. I've wanted to for a long time. He looked at her, his eyes brimming. But you can't, because maybe that little girl is out there, and maybe she needs you, and you have to be here for her. You have to stay. You have to, no matter what. Livia felt her own eyes filling up. He took off his glasses and pinched the bridge of his nose. Her mother found a way around that. Heroin. When she finally overdid it, I'm sure she told herself it was an accident. Maybe it even was. So now the vigil is mine alone. Mine, and maybe people like me. Because how many people, Livia, how many people could look you in the eye like I am right now and say, I know what you've been through, what you're going through. Well, I can, and I do. They sat in silence after that. A couple of cops Livia knew came in but steered clear, probably sensing something in the atmosphere at the table. Little told her more. He'd been looking for someone like Livia, someone motivated the way he was, but younger, more capable, someone who knew the streets. 2 months earlier, he had read about Senator Ezra Lone's death from a heart attack in a Bangkok hotel. Little had connections in Bangkok and dug deeper. The heart attack story began to sound like bullshit. He learned Ezra Lone was the brother of Fred Lone, which led him to Livia. He checked ICE records and learned Livia happened to be in Thailand when Ezra Lone expired. The FBI flew a team out there to investigate. Did you know that? He asked. She was suddenly wary again. She said nothing. Oh, yes. A lot of people know it wasn't a heart attack. What they don't know, and never will, is who did it. Because a certain federal law enforcement expert on Thai crime groups and police corruption fed them false information that led them in unhelpful directions. She looked at him. And now I'm going to owe you for that? You don't owe me anything. I owe you. Owe me? You used me. If I used you,
It was by giving you everything you wanted most in the world.
You could have...
No, Livia. You wouldn't have believed me. This was the only way. And if you hadn't wanted it, you would have walked away. Just like you can walk away now. I'll keep your secrets either way. I told you, I owe you.
She wondered if owe you meant own you. But somehow, it didn't feel that way.
All I'm asking, he said, is that you think about it. What we could do together. My intel, your street smarts. Think of the people we could punish and the children we could save.
It's a lot.
I know.
I want to be left alone for a while, and however long a while is, I need you to respect it.
He gave her the big, sunny smile, the one she'd sensed at that first meeting he used to lull people.
Tough to the end, and yes, I will respect it, and I'll always be hoping you'll call.
On her way back to her desk, Livia stopped by Strangeland's office. The lieutenant would have known Little was in the building, as she seemed to know about everything that mattered. Better to initiate that conversation than make Strangeland come to her. Livia tapped on the door window and, when Strangeland looked up from the paperwork in front of her and nodded, went in. She closed the door behind her and stood.
"What did he want?" Strangeland asked.
Livia smiled, not remotely surprised.
"He's still pitching me to be on his task force."
"What did you tell him?"
"I told him it wasn't for me."
But the truth was, she wasn't sure what she had told Little, or what she wanted.
Strangeland nodded. "It's good you faced your demons, then."
"Yeah."
"Did you exercise them?"
For a moment, she remembered her last days in Bangkok, waking up in Fallon's apartment, Carl by her side, an IV in her arm. It turned out Fallon was a former Marine corpsman and a hell of a prepper. While she'd been out, he and Carl had thrown the Kawasaki in the back of the van, gotten her safe, and tended to her injuries. She'd spent 2 days in bed. She slept a lot but wasn't idle. Between Little's files and new intel from Kanazaki, it was easy to track down the last two men who had been involved in her and Nassan's kidnapping, the one who had been in the van and the one who had whipped that little boy, Kai, in the field. And as much as she hated to ask for help, in her condition she knew she couldn't do it herself. So she asked Carl. He told her he'd see what might be done. The next morning, he brought a canvas duffel to the bed and unzipped it. Inside was a sniper rifle.
"Nothing better than having a man like Kanazaki in your debt," he said. "Who else could deliver something like an RPA Rangemaster 50 cal with a Schmidt and Bender PM2 tactical scope practically wrapped in a red bow? The man's a miracle worker, I've always said so."
Like the others, the men were both cops. They worked in the countryside, in Chiang Rai. Carl had driven her out in one of Fallon's vans. He shot one from the top of an abandoned construction site. The other was from a slight rise in a rice paddy. Both were 1,000-yard shots. It was a little bittersweet to let someone else pull the trigger, but she was glad she got to see his expression when he was behind a scope, relaxed and yet focused, as she had expected, and watching the men's heads explode through a pair of binoculars had offered some satisfaction, too. She shook Fallon's hand when they said goodbye and thanked him. He waved it off.
"I told you," he said. "I was getting bored. I should thank you. Come back sometime. We'll make some more trouble."
Carl drove her to the airport. They parked and both stood at the curb. A traffic cop waved that Carl should move on, and Carl waved back and yelled,
"Yes, sir, on my way right now, and thank you."
He looked at the bag she'd placed on the ground.
"You gonna be all right with that?"
he asked. She looked at him and frowned. What she was carrying wasn't much more than a purse. With her ribs and the bruised liver Fallon had diagnosed, she couldn't handle a lot of weight, but still.
"I think I'll manage," she said.
"Because if you're looking for a porter, you know I'm available."
She smiled at that.
"You're a lot more than a porter."
"Well, I try."
She wanted to get the goodbye over with, but there was something she wanted to ask.
"Hey," she said, "what were you about to say when Dylan had the drop on you? Here's the thing about women?"
He laughed.
I was so scared I barely remember. But I think it was probably something like, if I ever find the right one, I'm never going to let her go.
She was surprised at how much that hurt. He'll find her, Carl.
He looked at her as though struggling for the right words. Then he said, LaBie, I think you're...